Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. My guest this week is Greg Ipp, the Wall Street Journal's chief economics commentator. I've long been an admirer of Greg's work, and I find his insights into how our economy functions to be really thoughtful as well as approachable. And it's also why I thought he'd be the perfect person to talk with about the central disconnect we've seen in perceptions of our economy over the last few years, namely that the markets and Wall Street think, hey, everything is going great. And American consumers are saying, nope, we think it still stinks. We also talk about AI. Why Greg thinks it's not likely to have a huge impact on our jobs, but why it's potentially contributing to Americans' generally pessimistic views of their economic futures. But as you know, there's a war with Iran that's adding its own economic uncertainty to the mix. So we start the conversation there. We recorded this on Wednesday, March 11th. Greg Ipp, hello. Thank you so much for joining me.
Amy, thanks a lot for having me on the show.
Oh, I've been so excited for this conversation. I've been trying to get you on the pod for a little while now because I'm an avid reader of all of your columns in the Wall Street Journal. And I think you do such an amazing job of breaking down the economy in a way that non-economist people like myself can understand. It's really insightful and thoughtful. And so I thought we were going to start with sort of a big picture look at where the economy is, but we're right now in the middle of a war in Iran. So
yep.
I think we have to start there and its impact on the economy. Tell me what you're seeing right now about the impact that this war is having. And then we can talk maybe about where you think things go from here.
Great question, Amy. And first of all, the admiration is all mutual. I've loved Cook Political Report, yours and Charlie's work over the years. Big admirer. It's an honor to be on your show. So let's step back a little bit, okay? This is not our first Gulf War, obviously. The Gulf, being the source of most of the world's cheap oil, has been a source of geopolitical and economic disruption going back since either of us were born, frankly. You go back to the 73 Arab oil embargo, 79 Iran Revolution, the 91 Gulf War, the 2003 Gulf War. So in some sense, we have a muscle memory for these things. And it goes like this. Higher energy prices, bad for both growth and consumers, and also bad for inflation. And that's one of the reasons why markets and individuals tend to respond very badly to events like we're having right now. However, this is not your father's oil price shock. What do I mean by that? So a couple things have changed in important ways since the last time this happened, which I would say would be around 2003, or we could even look at 2022, frankly, when Russia invaded Ukraine. So the first thing that happens is we just don't consume as much energy relative to GDP as we used to. Here's a stat for you. We consumed 5% less gasoline in total gallons last year than we did in 2007, almost 20 years ago. But our GDP was 42% larger. So what does that mean? It basically means we use about half as much gasoline per dollar of GDP than we used to. So based on that, a dollar increase in the price of oil or gasoline is simply not going to have as big effect as it used to have. Number two, the United States was historically, through most of that period, a net oil importer. So you both had the fact that consumers were spending more on energy when these price spikes happened. And all that money that they were spending went overseas to foreign oil producers, right? So it was kind of a double whammy. Now, a lot of that money actually flows back to Americans because we have the shale revolution. So there's, in some sense, before it was unambiguously bad because it was bad for consumers and bad for producers. But now it's bad for consumers, but there's a little bit of a positive for producers. And so that's one another reason why we don't think it'll be as bad. The third thing, Amy, and this is the one where we really, nobody should have much conviction, is that the damage from an oil event like now is it's a function of two things: how much the price goes up and how long it stays there. We know the first thing, but we don't know the second. And the wild gyrations we've seen in price in the last week or two. I mean, I was watching the futures on Sunday night. It was insane. They went as high as $120. The next day, they were down to $105 in the morning, and they ended the day down for the day. I've never seen volatility like this. So what's the message from that? Humility. Don't make strong forecasts.
But Greg, even in what you're seeing on the street corner, at my gas station on the corner, on a week ago, it was $3 a gallon. It's now up to $3.35. I've never seen it go that quickly. So consumers are also seeing it, not just the markets.
Yeah, so the speed of increase is definitely something that's going to shock people. But okay, step back a little bit. The level of the price is roughly where it was a little over a year ago when President Trump came into office. And if you actually add up how much money is likely to be drained out of consumers' pockets as a result of the higher gasoline prices we're seeing right now, it's still probably less than they're going to get back from the tax cuts in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So I sit here and based on the probabilities of where things go, I'm not too worried about the economy.
Okay. And yet, can I just read the last sentence of your piece on this, which to me was kind of, it was just
now
a
that's
nice
a low
little,
blow, Amy, reading back to me something I wrote.
Well, it's just this little nugget that you put at the end where you said, President Trump, eager to run the economy hot ahead of the midterms, has put intense pressure on the Fed to slash rates. If it succumbs, a temporary oil-induced inflation blip could be something longer lasting. So can you explain what that means?
Sure. So if you go back to the 1970s, which was kind of the archetypal energy shock,
right?
All right. So that did exactly the two things I said oil shocks do. It reduced oil, it hurt the economy. We had a recession in 73, 74, and it caused inflation to go up. Now, any economist will tell you is that if oil prices go up, that will have a one-time impact on inflation. But unless they keep going up year after year after year, which nobody thinks is likely to happen, then it should fade once you get past the 12 months over which you measure the inflation rate. Unless the Federal Reserve, which is essentially the guardian on inflation, drops the ball and allows that higher energy prices to work its way back into the prices of other goods and services and wages. And that's what happened in the 1970s. The Fed dropped the ball. They simply did not respond forcefully enough to the damage that was being done to the underlying dynamics of inflation. And one of the reasons they didn't respond forcefully enough is that under Chair Arthur Burns, they had been basically deeply politicized. President Nixon put a lot of pressure on the Fed in 72 not to raise rates. And we had an inflation problem even before the oil shock. Now, why does that matter today? Because we once again have a president who is not just privately, but publicly putting a lot of pressure on the Fed to lower interest rates. Now, there might be a case for the Fed to lower interest rates sometime in the 12 months once we're past this oil shock. But if instead of lowering rates based on their own assessment of the outlook, they're doing it to please a president, that's the kind of thing I worry about embedding a longer lasting inflation problem and repeating the mistakes of the past.
Thank you. That helps me understand that a little bit better, I think. And it leads me to the question that I wanted to start this conversation with, which is, as you very well know, the economy is key in every single election, but in this midterm, especially when voters are saying overwhelmingly that's their top concern, especially the cost of living and inflation. So there's a big disconnect here, though, Greg. As you know, voters are saying overwhelmingly we think the economy is bad, and the markets are saying no, it's not. We think it's pretty good. So who's right?
Amy, this feels kind of like Groundhog Day to me, because if you and I were having this conversation in the summer of 2024, the questions would have been the same. data would have been the same and the answers would have been the same, which is the data tell us that the economy is doing well, the stock market is very happy, the inflation rate has come down a lot, and people are miserable as heck, and they are going to take it out on the incumbent party.
That's right.
And oh my God, it just feels like, you know, just take out the name Biden and then, you know, like copy and paste in Trump, and it's exactly the same story. Look, so a couple things. First of all, it is not people's imagination that costs are going up. They are. When an inflation rate is positive, that is arithmetically telling us that prices are going up. Now, they're going up at a relatively reasonable rate. We learned, you and I are talking today on a Wednesday. On this morning, we learned that the consumer price index for February was up only a little bit in the month of February. The inflation rate was 2.4%, which is actually not a bad inflation rate. It just means that prices went up 2.4% in the last 12 months, which is in keeping with its long-run trend. The problem for the average American is it comes after a five-year period when they were up like 25%, and they want them to go down. And that's what they've been telling us for 2 years. I don't care that they're going up slowly. I want them to go down, and they're not going down. And the problem for Trump, I think, it's not just that people are feeling grouchy about this and have been waiting for years for relief. It's that he campaigned explicitly on a promise to bring them down. To give you one simple example, on one of his campaign events, he said he was going to lower the price of energy, all energy, not just gasoline, but energy by 50% in his first 12 to 18 months. Well, it's 13 months in and the price of energy is up 0.3% through February, and it will be up more in March. So Trump doesn't just have the issue that the facts on the ground continue to vex people, but he promised things that have not happened. So in some sense, he's got double trouble on the affordability front.
And how realistic, this is Republicans' argument, so I want you to sort of fact check this. How realistic do you think their hope of this stronger tax refund season, right? The one big beautiful bill, as you pointed out, is going to put more money in people's pockets? Maybe they know this, maybe they don't, but Republicans would like to remind voters during the election season that that extra money in their pocket is thanks to them and their legislation, and that this tax bill is also going to help give some certainty to businesses who will then pass that on to consumers. So by the time we hit the fall, people will feel a little less anxious about their pocketbook.
So I would say that based on the pure facts of the question, they're right.
Yeah.
This bill will put more money in the pockets of the median taxpayer. It will deliver some certainty to businesses. The economy will be stronger this year than otherwise would have been. When I talked about Trump wanting to run the economy hot, it wasn't just about keeping low interest rates down and pushing them down further. It was also about exactly this, you know, cutting taxes, running the deficit larger. All that stuff is true. The bridge from the facts on the economy to how people feel about that and then how they respond at the polls is very different.
Yeah.
Now, you and I can go back to ancient history, all the way back to 2018, when we had a different Republican. We had Trump was still a president. Republicans controlled Congress. They passed something called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And it, too, was intended to deliver a nice little jolt of good feeling ahead of the midterms. And it did. 2018 was a very good year for the economy. But throughout the year 2018, and I will say this surprised me, that bill continued to be underwater with political polling. People just didn't like it for reasons that, honestly, I as an economics guy never really fully understood. People did not approve of a tax bill that was explicitly designed to put more money in their pockets. And so I would say that history is not kind to the notion that a tax cut gives you immediate rewards, you know, at the polling station. I think that all else equal, in other words, the Republicans will do better than they would have absent this thing. I just think that there's so many other things that are getting on people's nerves these days.
Right.
It won't be the make or break issue that Republicans had hoped it would be.
Right. And let's talk about that inflation point that you brought up. And I've been thinking about this for a while and curious your take on it. The level of inflation that we saw right after the pandemic is like nothing we had seen in, 40 years. And so for those of us who are of a certain age, we have never experienced anything like this in our life. We have maybe seen little blips in inflation, but never to this degree. And so it seems like the shock of that inflation is so much
harder for Americans to shake off because they don't have muscle memory of it in the same way they may have in the 70s and 80s and 90s when they had been sort of accustomed to seeing spikes and drops in inflation. Is that a fair way to think about this, that we just were not accustomed to this? And so the idea that, as you said, Greg, you can just keep telling consumers, but it's getting better, right? Because instead of inflation going up 20%, it's only going up 2%. So that $15 burrito is not going to be $25. But guess what? That $15 burrito is never going to be $10 again, right? How do you make an understanding of this?
So I would say that you're absolutely right that the inflation that we suffered through in 22 and 23 was well outside the experience of most, you know, American adults now. But I would also say that that was 3 years ago now, right?
Yeah.
And it's got to be the case that with each passing year, the shock has got to fade. And indeed, you know, we do see some data. For example, if you look at if you dig down a little bit, you know, take Trump out of the equation, and you ask people their assessment of the economy, we do see that although people are still net negative, they're not quite as negative as they were a year or two ago. And that is what I would have predicted, which is that when something bad happens to the economy, that as long as it doesn't keep repeating itself, it will fade into the background and other things will take precedence over that. The second point I'd like to make is that about a couple years ago when I was first trying to confront this like vexing disconnect between the data which was good and people's attitudes which were bad, I came up with what I called my referred pain thesis. And this is the idea that in medicine, we know that sometimes if you have a headache, it's because you're actually suffered an injury to your leg. It's called referred pain, right? And so my theory was that when people tell the polling organizations that they're negative about the economy, what they're really telling them is that they're negative in general. They're negative about a lot of things. You know, when they're worried about inflation, they're also worried about whether the kids are going to get jobs. They're worried about like the cost of housing. They're worried about like whether it was the war in Gaza or the war in Israel or what's going on with ICE or something like that. In other words, there tends to be, I think, this leakage of people's pessimism across all things that they're looking at. And you kind of can see that. And you know this way better than I do. But there's a high degree of correlation. Like pollsters will ask people, issue by issue, how do you feel about the economy? How do you feel about immigration? How do you feel about healthcare? How do you feel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And there's a high correlation across all these things. And yet it cannot be the case that foreign policy and healthcare are always moving the same direction.
Right.
So honestly, Amy, one of my theories of the case right now is that when people tell them they're upset about affordability or they're upset about inflation or the economy, what they're really telling you is they're just upset, period. And honestly, the last time the country on net thought we were, the last time the polls said that people on net felt we were on the wrong track, I think it was like 2006.
On the right track, you mean?
On the right track. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah.
On the right track.
Yeah.
We have almost this structural pessimism in the country right now. And today people are indexing on affordability because that's kind of like what's salient.
Yep.
But even there, nobody's really clear what they mean by affordability because affordability really has two pieces. It's not just the cost of the stuff you buy. It's also the income, the resources you have to buy it, right? So when people complain about affordability, which do they mean? The fact that things cost a lot or that their income isn't going up very much, right? And those are actually two different things.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Greg Ebb.
Hey there, it's Erin Covey, the House Editor here at the Cook Political Report. Did you know we have another podcast called Editor's Roundtable? It comes out once a week and features me and my colleagues pulling back the curtain to let you in on all of our insights on races, ratings changes, polling, and everything else we'll be following this midterm year. You can find Editor's Roundtable on Apple Podcasts for just $1.99 a month or become a paying subscriber to our new Cook Political Report Substack. All this is linked in the episode's show notes.
There was a really interesting number in the Wall Street Journal, I'm sorry, it used to be the Wall Street Journal, NBC poll that came out this week. And it feels like that issue you're talking about, this idea of things being worse, the pessimism, you can kind of go back to 2008, right? And look at the financial crisis as one of the most important catalysts to that. And we just seem every couple years, there's something else that builds on this overall feeling, which leads me to my question that I've been thinking about this a lot. I quote your column on this a lot. The more taking a step back, a more holistic look at the state of our economy, I think this is true for the US, I think this is true for a lot of the world, which is that, this was your column, the economy's rewards are going disproportionately toward capital instead of labor. Profits have soared since the pandemic, the market value attached to those profits even more. The result, capital, which includes businesses, shareholders, superstar employees, is triumphant, while the average worker ekes out marginal gains. As you said, Greg, you're not going to solve that by running on an affordability argument, right? This is deeper than that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is this where we are? Is this where we're going to be for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think that the point that I was making in that column that you just quoted is relevant to the current debate in the following way, is that on top of all the issues of affordability, to the extent that we are getting good numbers on the GDP and the stock market, they are reflective of a somewhat narrow slice of the economy. I mean, the economists will tell you is that we had a good year for GDP growth last year, but it was a good year partly because we had a boom in AI, everybody's building a data center, and that the people who own a lot of the stock market did extremely well, and their spending seems to be disproportionately holding up the economy. And so I think that goes exactly to the heart of, you know, this disconnect you and I are talking about, which is that one reason why good data is not lifting people's spirits is because that good data is not really telling us how the median household is doing.
Right.
Now, I don't want to get all Debbie Downer here, because if we do look at some of the median data, like average wages and so on for like blue collar workers, they are ahead of inflation. Okay, I don't want to sort of like fall into this, pessimistic trap of saying that we're all poorer than we were 10 or 20 years ago. That's just not true, okay? But it does explain why you can have a great year in the stock market and it's not like doing much for people's spirits, which, by the way, I think is one of the shortcomings of Trump's fixation on the stock market, right, is that he sees it as a real-time barometer on his track record, and I suppose in some sort of like clinical way it is, but it's not really doing much for the average household. Now, the other reason I think it's relevant is that the stock market isn't just telling us how the economy is doing now. It's also kind of forward-looking, right? It's telling us how's it going to do in the future. And I think in the last 12 months, one of the things that I find especially intriguing is how much that of that outperformance of the stock market is related to AI. And, you know, I don't know where you were during the dot-com boom, but I'd actually just started at the Wall Street Journal. I was actually a stock market reporter, right? And so I have all these great stories. And I remember, I talk about this with folks often, but the dot-com boom was kind of like this crazy, joyous event.
Everyone was in such a great mood. We were going to make billions just by coming up with the name of a dot something, right?
True story. One of my colleagues at the Journal quit to go work at a dot-com. And that dot-com went public at some insane valuation. And like a bunch of us in the office would every day say, oh, Dave's worth X million, Dave's worth Y million today, right? We all sort of had this sense that it was crazy when it's going to end, but there was this like joyous sense of possibility about it.
Yes.
Nobody feels that way about AI.
Nope.
And when you hear people talking about all the jobs that AI is going to destroy and like but even if you as an adult feel pretty good about yourself, you're worried about your kids, like what are they going to do for a job?
Yep.
So I think that's kind of part of this disconnect as well, is that we are experiencing this revolutionary technology. It's helping the GDP. It's helping the stock market. But the average American, when they're told what the AI can and will do, isn't feeling very good about it.
Well, isn't part of it too, Greg, that what the average American is hearing in some ways is coming from the people who are building the AI tools, right? It's one thing for me as a non-AI person to say, I'm worried about this. But when you hear the head of Anthropic and these other folks who work in this industry say, oh yeah, this is gonna wipe out all white collar jobs. Tell me if I'm wrong, but nobody was saying that in the dot-com boom. They were saying anybody could get rich, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, somebody put it to me this way. It's not clear that you want like a Sam Altman, you know, or an Elon Musk to be the leading spokesman of this technology, right? Because they have not shown a great ability to read the room.
There's a lot of empathy coming out of it.
Exactly.
Well, what happened?
Right. you know, and we could have a conversation about the political risks to this administration aligning itself so closely with that particular movement, but that might be for a different day. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that when the persistent message from the people who supposedly know the most is that you need to worry about your job, you need to start storing canned food, it's not encouraging. Now, I would, by the way, I can't move on from this subject without saying that when I look at the data, I don't think there's an apocalypse coming. I just don't. You know what I mean? We could have a longer conversation about that. But you and I are talking about the mood and how people are reacting to it, like in an ambient sense.
But when you look at the data, what does it tell you right now about what AI is actually doing? Is it the case that if you're a young kid coming out of college right now, there is no entry-level job for you? Because that's the conventional wisdom out there.
Okay. So a few things that we can tell you with some confidence. Okay, we know that adoption of AI is picking up.
Yep.
But we don't see much evidence that the firms that are adopting AI are yielding such great cost savings that they're able to lay a lot of people off. We simply do not see a lot of AI-driven layoffs in the data. There are, like, occasionally, like, Jack Dorsey comes along and he's saying...
I was just going to say, so the Jack Dorsey thing...
Jack Dorsey, yes, and for our listeners who don't know who Jack Dorsey is, he was a founder of Twitter. Yep. He's a founder of the Square Cash app, which is now, I think, called Block. And so a few weeks ago, he said he was laying off 40% of employees because they can do so much more with AI, which is kind of like a terrifying thing, right? Well, then a few people started pointing out, hey, Jack Dorsey, you are only going back to the number of employees you had back in 2022. Kind of looks to us like you overhired, you got kind of sloppy, and now you're trying to like make up for your own management mistakes and you're trying to like tie an AI bow and put it on that there. Isn't that really what's going on? And so... when you actually like penetrate below the Silicon Valley kind of like hype, even when you look at an announcement like Jack Dorsey's, it's not really clear that what's going on is that AI is saving a lot of jobs, as opposed to I got to lay some folks off and I'm going to grab the corporate management speak phrase du jour and I'm going to say it's because AI does X,
Y, Z. Nobody can be mad at me.
Exactly.
They're gonna
you know,
be mad at
and
this computer.
You know, a bad manager lays off people because you overhired. A good manager lays off people because of AI, right? So excuse me, I know you don't expect me, somebody as young as me, to be so cynical, but what can I say? Okay, yeah. But let's talk about the data, which is my area of expertise. If we look at the number of people whose job occupation is software developer, that number's going up right now. It's not going down.
Huh.
Some of the lower level jobs like computer programmer, the people who manage the IT systems, their numbers are going down, but they've been going down for 20 years, frankly. If we look at job vacancies, job openings for computer related occupations, those peaked in 2022. And the reason they peaked was that there was a hiring binge at big tech coming out of the pandemic. And then they figured out that they overdid it. And so they have actually been cutting back since early 2022, which was 10 months before ChatGPT was released. And you don't really see much of a trend since then. In fact, you actually, if you squint, you can see a small uptick in these jobs. Another interesting data point, Amy, is that if you do salary surveys, and we don't have up-to-date data on this, but the last numbers I saw on this were for 2024. According to those data surveys, a computer grad, somebody with a computer science degree is still earning more than somebody with just a regular degree. And that premium continues to grow. It's not shrinking, it's growing. However, I do want to confront this fact that if you're in your early 20s with a college degree, it's harder to find a job. That is true. It is definitely the case that the unemployment rate for young college grads is going up. But is it because of AI? That is a hypothesis, and I don't want to dismiss the possibility. But I think a stronger theory is that for the last year or two, we are in what economists are calling a low-hire, low-fire environment. People are not getting laid off. People are not quitting their jobs. And because of that, there are fewer vacancies. And because there are fewer vacancies, fewer people are getting hired. Who suffers the most when the people are not getting hired? The ones who are just out of college and don't have any experience. So if you were to ask me, why is it hard for somebody with a college degree in their early 20s to find a job right now? I'd say it's much more likely that sort of structural no-hire environment than it is AI.
Thank you for helping to put that into context. But as we think about this longer term, Greg, and as you noted, both in our conversation and in your writing about this, look, we've had technological change for as long as we've had humans. And this sort of gloom and doom scenario has always been out there. And at the end of the day, there's not been one technology that has completely wiped out, right, the economy or employment. So put that into one bucket. On the other hand, we do know that changing technology does change our culture, our society, and our politics. And so the hollowing out of the upper Midwest and manufacturing has had significant impact, again, on the society that lived there, on the cultural impact of it, and then, of course, on the politics of it. So if you're thinking longer sort of picture on this, and this is what you're hearing from political folks is, okay, if the 80s and 90s were about the displacement of blue collar work, especially in the upper Midwest, is the rest of the 21st or the foreseeable 21st century going to be about the displacement of white collar work and its impact on our politics?
So I would say, first of all, this is exactly the right question to be asking. Mm. I've even heard some people say this will be even more convulsive than the loss of blue-collar work in manufacturing, because if you look back through time, revolutions are always started by the bourgeoisie, the middle class, the students, and so on.
Right.
So, in some, you know, but can I say something, by the way? And this is just a reflection I've had, and I made a passing reference in a column a little while ago, that are people in knowledge work, which is what you and I do for a living,
right,
are we just now confronting what people, blue-collar workers, have been living with for 40 or 50 years?
That's
I mean, I've been feeling a little bit guilty about this, right?
Right.
As you say, people in Midwestern company towns were going through not just a year or two, but decades of convulsive change due to free trade with Mexico, outsourcing, automation, free trade with China, town after town, wave after wave of layoffs. And in some sense, I think a lot of folks in the upper middle class and the people in the knowledge sectors didn't really internalize how socially convulsive that was until, honestly, President Trump was elected in 2016.
Exactly.
So I think these are exactly the right questions to be asking. Now, let's frame out just what we can expect. So to expect the white-collar job dislocation attributable to be AI to be on the same scale as what we saw with manufacturing work, you'd have to basically accept some of these doomer scenarios that we are looking at millions and millions of people displaced and unable to find new work. And as I said a second ago, we're not seeing it in the data yet. And I'm a believer that if something that big were about to happen, we ought to be seeing more evidence of it than we are now. And yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been around long enough to know that we were going to lose all the radiologists' jobs to outsourcing, and it never happened. All the translators were going to lose their job because of Google Translate. That didn't happen. All the media people were going to lose. All the people who were basically, when my industry went to like electronic typesetting and then to web-based publication, that industry was like, it's true that a lot of people in the printing industry lost their jobs. But then we created a lot of jobs in areas like web design and so forth. So I'm not right now today one of the doomers, but I also am aware that there are things about AI that are different. And I hear people who are thoughtful, who I respect, saying that this will be different and more convulsive with what I can do. And if you were to assume that this were, for example, to follow the contours of the China shock, which we had in 2001, even though that we lost millions of jobs to the China shock against a background when we were already losing millions of jobs in manufacturing, the economy still did okay through that period. Overall employment did rise. It was a good economy. But we know that there was something going on beneath the surface, right? We were seeing not just dislocation, we were seeing deaths of despair and so on. And that all kind of like came home to roost many years later. So I think that's part of what's driving the conversation in Washington right now. And one of the things that I find interesting is that I saw some statistic, I don't know whether you've seen this as well, there's like 4,000 bills in state legislatures and the federal legislature across the country dealing with AI. And that tells you we're already seeing kind of a backlash against it. The likely, I don't know where it goes, but it seems more likely to slow things down than to speed it up.
Well, and that does seem, Greg, like as we think about 2028, it feels as if you cannot be considered a serious candidate for president without having a platform that addresses this. And more likely than not, to your point, it's going to address it in a way that looks at AI more skeptically than optimistically. Is that your belief in that?
That would be my prediction.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I actually haven't seen it yet. Have you?
I haven't either, but.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I think, has talked about like stopping data centers and so on.
Yep, yep.
Right now, that's where I see, you know, most of the backlash surfacing at the political level, and even there, mostly at the state and local level, not at the federal level. So I'd actually love to hear your opinion on this. Do you think when 2028 rolls around, the effect on society and jobs will be a top tier issue?
That it will be a conversation. And so when I see these editorials and writings from some folks who are saying, oh, by 2028, 30% of the workforce will have lost their job, right? That obviously would put AI in the forefront. You can't have a conversation, a serious conversation as a presidential candidate without making that the centerpiece, right? If 30% of the workforce has been laid off. But if what we're really looking at is more like what you're seeing, Greg, which is we're in kind of this economy where no fire, no hire, where AI is having an impact, where people in their 20s are struggling to find jobs, where the cost of healthcare continues to go up, people continue to be worried about their parents and grandparents and their healthcare, we still sort of feel stuck, right? And it is leading to this idea of not just we had Donald Trump on the Republican side as the populist rule breaker, some ways, it feels as if Democrats are going to also feel that impact and want to put forward somebody who's going to be a populist rule breaker on the left, basically saying our economy, it's not just a one-term fix. This isn't just about, this is the AOC message, the Bernie Sanders message. This isn't about Donald Trump. What you're feeling, yes, you're frustrated about him, I get it, but it is structural. It is a system that is designed to help the wealthiest, and we live in this K-shaped economy that's only gonna get worse for regular people, and we gotta break that up. Is Wall Street sort of pricing that in to the way they think about the next few years, that this brewing frustration is going to come out in maybe a real fundamental change to the system?
No, Wall Street's pricing in nothing like that, but that's not surprising. Wall Street is simply awful at pricing in those kinds of mood changes. And
I don't know what that would look like, Greg.
Exactly. I don't know how you price it. What do you buy?
Mean?
What do you sell, you know?
Right.
And if you think that's only a 20% chance, that means there's an 80% chance it won't happen.
Right.
And if you put all your money on 20% and it doesn't happen, you basically end up losing money, right?
So that's right.
I would not expect it to happen on Wall Street. I would expect that at least among the more thoughtful leaders of the business and tech community, you would be having that thought process. And this is where I think it's interesting that the one figure in the AI space who's talking about it is Dario Amodei, right, from Anthropic. I mean, he is the guy who's talking about white-collar job loss most emphatically, but he's also the guy who seems most concerned about doing something about it and about putting guardrails around the industry to try and, at least, you know, prevent some of the worst-case scenarios.
Right.
And he's a bit of an outlier in the industry. So this is kind of one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I don't have a good answer for you. What is the political risk to industry and tech specifically of refusing to sort of grapple with these kinds of issues? Now, I don't expect 30% of white collar jobs to ever be lost to AI, much less in the next 2 years. But I think what you're talking about is that people are going to be, if they're still feeling crappy 2 years from now, they're going to be looking for someone to blame. Isn't that kind of what we're talking about here? Yeah.
Yeah.
And who's the opportunistic politician who's going to pick up on that, right? And it seems to me that, you know, after 08, it was the banks, understandably. And I would not be surprised if people decide to zero in on the tech community.
Right.
I just don't know exactly how that comes out or with who.
That's right. Greg, this has been a fascinating conversation, as usual. We could keep going on and on and on, although I would love to check in with you as we get like into the late summer, early fall, because we may have a better sense of all of these shocks we've been talking about and whether or not they have come to pass, either the good and the bad. But until then, we will leave it just as this.
Amy, it was a great conversation. Thanks so much for having me, and I'd be delighted if you have me back in the summer to mark to market everything we just talked about.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review. Or, better yet, recommend us to a friend. You are our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.